This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Tova Green, for those of you who don't know me. I live at San Francisco Zen Center, and I work there as well. About 6 months ago, I became the director of Zen Center, City Center. I'm very pleased to be here. It's been a while since I've spoken at Hartford Street Zen Center, and I want to thank Reverend Mio for inviting me to come today. So my talk today is going to investigate a phrase from the Genjo Koan, "Hear the way unfolds." What does that mean? Hear the way unfolds, the path of our practice. And for several months, I've been meeting with a group of five people to study the Genjo Koan. It's one of those deep and beautiful texts that you can study over and over again. And when sometimes studying it reminds me of playing the Bach suites on the cello, which I've been playing the cello since I was 10 years old, and I keep coming back to the Bach suites because they're so beautiful and keep revealing new delights, I guess you could say. And I feel it's the same with the Genjo Koan. It's really wonderful to explore it. So this phrase, "Hear the way unfolds," comes from a longer paragraph. When you find your place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find your way at this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. Meeting one thing is mastering it. Doing one practice is practicing completely. Here is the place. Here the way unfolds. I should back up a little bit and just say, in case you're not familiar with the Genjo Koan or the person who wrote it was written by Eihei Dogen, who was, some people call him the founder of our school of Zen practice, Soto Zen, and he lived in Japan about 800 years ago and wrote many essays on all aspects of practice. And so this is one that we sometimes chant at Zen Center, I began hearing it long before I began studying it, and at first it didn't make much sense, and it's gradually become more and more useful, relevant, and inspiring, I would say, as well. So in our study group, we talked about two questions related to this passage. What brings us to practice, and what keeps us practicing? And I think those are probably questions for all of us. You know, what brought you here this morning? What brings you to the cushion when you sit, whether it's at home or here or somewhere else? And what enables you to keep practicing day after day, week after week, for some of us year after year? What keeps it fresh and alive? How do we find our place where we are, and what happens when we find our place? These are some of the questions I hope to explore this morning. When you find your place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. And that is another way of expressing that everyday actions, things that we do in our lives day to day, are ways of manifesting or getting in touch with another realm of what we might call the absolute. So we function in a conventional time and conventional space and live our lives in fully meeting the everything we do from the time we wake up till the time we go to sleep. But there's another way in which we are part of, we're interconnected with each other, with all sentient beings, and with a reality that we may only get glimpses of. But I think these glimpses are part of what brings us to practice. And what brings us to practice may also be very tangible. So I want to explore both that kind of ineffable sense that we may have. There's something that is really speaking to us that we might not even have words for, and then the concrete realities of our lives. And I'd like to share a poem that I think brings up this contrast. It's a short poem by Jane Hirschfield. Jane Hirschfield is a local poet. She lives in Marin. And when she was young, she went to Tassajara and was there for a few years. And I think that practice informs some of her poetry. This one is called Tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already, the first branch tips brush at the window, softly, calmly. Immensity taps at your life. So my teacher, Linda Cutts, says every good poem should be read twice, so I'm going to read it again. Mm-hmm. She's probably not the only one who says it, but I like to bring her into the room. Tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already, the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. But I wonder, really, do we have to choose? I mean, can we have both? The clutter of cookbooks and soup pots and all of those things that enrich our lives, and that redwood tree growing outside our window. So I think when we talk about here is the place, here the way unfolds, that includes the clutter of cookbooks and soup pots and all the other manifestations of our lives. I'd like to share a koan, a teaching story, about a great teacher named Zhaozhou. Some of you may have heard this story. He lived in the born 700 in the year 778, and he died, this is according to Andy Ferguson, in the year 897. Which meant he lived about 120 years. And he was a student of a teacher named Nanxuan. So a monk came to meet him for the first time and said to Zhaozhou, "I have just entered this monastery. Please teach me." And Zhaozhou said, "Have you eaten your rice gruel?" Which was probably breakfast. And the monk said, "Yes, I have." And Zhaozhou said, "Wash your bowl." The monk understood, which I think is another way of saying the monk was enlightened or found realization, woke up. So this seems, you know, maybe very ordinary. Student came to a great teacher and asked for some teaching, and probably was expecting some words of great wisdom, and was met with something very practical. "Have you had breakfast?" And the monk said, "Yes." "Then, well then, do the next thing. Wash your bowl." And there's something about our practice that I think is very concrete. Be present when you eat your breakfast. Notice what you're eating. Actually, today at Zen Center, we on Saturday morning, we often have Orioki breakfast. So we sit in the Zendo, and it's formal breakfast with three bowls, and there are students who serve the food. And it's a very beautiful practice of slowing down. It's done in silence, really noticing it's kind of dance between the server and the person being served. And you have a chance to notice the steam rising from the cereal and the taste of each dish and kind of really tuning into, I've been much more aware of when I've had enough and how much I really need in that practice of eating breakfast. So, and then we wash our bowls. The servers bring water, we wash our bowls, we dry our bowls, we wrap them up, and we're ready to go. It's a beautiful practice. So, but in this story, you know, Zhaozhou met this monk in the present moment, and I think that's an illustration of here is the place. Here the way unfolds. It can come from something very, we might think of something ordinary, something we do every day, but can we meet these things that we do every day with the kind of mind that can be surprised, excited, find something fresh in the things that we do every day. So I thought I would tell a little bit of my own way-seeking mind story today, just a couple of short excerpts, I think I might call it that, about what brought me to practice and to Zen practice. But when I think of what, you know, it's what brought me to practice, I could start with when I moved to San Francisco and first went to Green Gulch, but I think it actually started a long time before that, when I was in high school. And I had a wonderful literature teacher, and she had us memorize some poems. So one of the ones that I loved was The Daffodils by William Wordsworth, which starts, "I wandered lonely as a cloud." I wandered lonely as a cloud. I remembered it earlier today. "Oh, that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze." And then later on in the poem he says, "I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth to me that show hath brought. For oft when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon the inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude." And that's the line that stuck with me, that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And what was that inward eye? So that, I think, planted a question for me. And I think that percolated in my mind. And actually, you know, I don't have a very good memory now for it's hard for me to memorize poetry now, but I just appreciate the gift of that poem, which when I was younger was easier to memorize poetry, and that has really stayed with me my whole life. So another experience I had when I was in high school was going to Girl Scout camp. And I was in, because I was one of the older campers by then, we were in what we called a pioneering unit. And so we went on 3-day hikes and canoe portages, and that experience of being in nature, paddling on a lake, just seeing mountains, feeling the sunshine, the rhythm of paddling with another camper was something that really, I think, touched me deeply, because I grew up in New York City and I didn't have much experience of wilderness except for camp. So, and then at the end of the day, our group would get together and we would cook meals together on an open fire. And I think that was one of my first experiences of community, of sangha and living in community, which has become a very important part of my life. And then I would find when I went home to my family the hot applesauce with gingerbread dumplings that was so delicious over an open fire just didn't have the same appeal, and my family didn't appreciate it. But anyway, that was, for me, a seed was planted then. And so, you know, I just invite you to take a moment to think about some of the seeds that may have been planted in your own lives that contributed to your being here today. It can be a circuitous route, but things touch us in ways we may not appreciate the significance of them at the time, but they can have a ripple effect. So I would say, I started meditating much later, in my 30s, and initially I was then living in Boston, and I used to go to retreats at the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, so I was a Vipassana practitioner for many years. And then when I moved to San Francisco about 22 years ago, I was looking for a place to practice, and I went to Green Gulch on a Sunday, and somehow I just knew that I wanted to go back, and that became the place that I went to every week. And I was living in the East Bay, so I went to Berkeley Zen Center during the day, and I mean during the week on in the mornings, and gradually got more and more involved in Zen practice. And it was at Green Gulch where I met my teacher, Linda Cutts. So when I think about what are some of the things that sustain our practice, I want to touch on four things, and I also want to leave time for questions, so I'll just tell you what the four things are and talk a little bit about each one. So I think, of course, Zazen is the foundation, I think, of our practice. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to sit on the cushion every day, I think, especially if you sit at home and don't have the support of a community. But I think even then, you probably find, even when there are gaps in your practice, that it feels good to come back to the cushion, and it's almost like a home base. To have that opportunity to just be still and notice what arises moment to moment, I think can be a great gift, even though at times it can also be quite challenging. But I think making a commitment to sit can really change our lives. And one of the things, when I asked Linda to be my teacher, she just said she would be my teacher as long as I agreed to sit every day. And I was not living at Zen Center then. I was living as a householder, and I saw things starting to shift that really surprised me. So I think that is one of the things that Zazen can deepen our experience of ourselves and our lives, and can help us meet each moment freshly. And then the second thing that I think sustains practice is working with a teacher. And I think it's very hard after a while, I think, to practice on your own. I think questions come up, you really want to talk with someone about them. And I think a teacher can be a great friend and support. And I feel very fortunate in that I've had the opportunity to work with my teacher for, I guess it's 14 years now, and I received lay ordination from Linda, and then some years later I was ordained as a priest, and then I did a practice period with her at Tassajara when I was head student, and I still meet with her every week when she's in town and talk about things that are challenging for me, things that are going well, questions about practice, any important decisions I really want her input on, and she's there to provide it. So I feel very blessed. I don't think I would be where I am. I certainly wouldn't be the director of City Center if I didn't have her support and encouragement. So whatever stage you're at in practice, I think it's very helpful to have a teacher. And then third thing is having Dharma friends. I think also, you know, to have peers, to have people you sit with, people who are studying, asking questions, people you can go to Dharma events with, I think it's very beneficial. And again, I also think I wouldn't enjoy practice nearly as much as I do if it weren't for Dharma friends. And I won't spend much time talking about that, but I encourage you to develop your Dharma friendships, because I think they will help sustain your practice. And then, you know, there are some, I would say, the last thing I would like to talk about is studying the precepts. I think, is there anyone who doesn't know what that means? So, it's possible to look at practice as a three-legged stool. One of the legs is meditation. One of the legs is called wisdom or study, learning about the teachings. And the third is living a life, an ethical life, or a life that can be informed by precepts about how to conduct ourselves in our lives. So, for example, the one precept is, and they are often phrased in a negative, but there's a positive side that goes with them. So the precept of not killing, but cherishing life is one. Or not taking what is not given, but giving freely what you have to give. So studying the precepts and kind of making a commitment to follow the precepts, be guided by the precepts. Follow might be a little too strict, because I think with studying the precepts, there's a way of studying them with compassion, so that they're not rules, or not seen as rules, or sometimes they have a negative connotation if people have grown up with commandments, you know, that can feel very restrictive. But instead, they're a way of really investigating what we do, what we say, how we interact with others and with ourselves in a way that allows us to feel connected with each other. They're really based on a sense of interconnectedness, on this other reality that we're sometimes able to tap into. So I think, I'd say one aspect of studying the precepts sometimes can lead to deciding to receive the precepts in a ceremony. It's called jukai, or receiving the precepts, and part of preparing for that is sewing a raksu. So if you look around, you'll see a few people are wearing raksus today. And there's a way in which receiving the precepts, you also receive a Dharma name from your teacher at that ceremony. And the ceremony is a public ceremony, so you receive the precepts in the presence of others and take a vow to not only live according to the precepts or mindful of the precepts, but the bodhisattva vow, which is sometimes it's called a bodhisattva initiation ceremony, which has to do with living your life for the benefit of all beings. So that doesn't exclude yourself. So taking care of yourself, but also being available for others and making that an important priority in your life. So I think those are some of the things that help sustain our practice. And I'd say when we begin the path of practice, we really don't know where it's going to lead. And the seed is planted, and then it just grows and may surprise you some of the ways it blossoms. So I thought I would read Jane's poem one more time and then see if there are any questions or comments. So this is Tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. So are there any questions or comments? Terry?
When you talked about the four aspects that could support your practice, it seemed to me that Dharma friends is something that the other three were things that I could see that you can consciously take steps to make them happen, but Dharma friends seem to be something that just happens or doesn't. I wonder how how you would recommend nurturing Dharma friends.
I think I don't think it just happens, you know, that you either have Dharma friends or you don't have Dharma friends. I think it's something that you cultivate just like you would cultivate a relationship with a teacher. And I know it's not necessarily easy to find people you think would be good Dharma friends. But some... and I know you've tried, so... excuse me, but Terry is someone that I've talked with before, so... but I think it... there are many ways. You know, one way, I know at City Center, people come and volunteer in different parts of the program, working in the kitchen, staffing the library, the bookstore, helping with special events. I think if you just, you know, that sometimes enables people through working with others on a project or on a crew to make some connections that are, you know, can last. Taking classes, but I think that might not necessarily be enough, you know. Coming here and staying for tea, time after time, you begin to get to know people and then, you know, talk with them, and I know Hartford Street has movie nights and other events to help people get to know each other. So it takes time, and I think it takes a certain amount of willingness to be to just try again if at first you don't succeed, you know, to keep at it. Yeah, and some of those friendships, I think, can... So I would just say, keep trying. I think you might find some people you really resonate with. You can be good Dharma friends. I hope that's helpful. Yeah, thanks. Anyone else? Jim?
Hi, so thanks for your great talk. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the tree in the house. It does seem to be a paradox to allow a tree that will eventually break the foundation of the house. But I also understand what I think is the Zen parallel to that, or paradox to that, of accepting things as they are and just enjoying the beauty of what is. Being a person who over plans and over worries, you know, I'm already worried about that little house. So what am I going to do?
Well, I think you left your little house.
I did leave my little house.
and moved in here. So, you know, I think that's an example of when this tree that starts out really small gets bigger and bigger, and it can shake up your life, and you do things you might never have thought you would do. So I think that's an example of, you know, kind of, you know, if anyone had said to me 15 years ago that, you know, I would be living at Zen Center and be a priest and be the director of Zen Center, and, you know, that this would be the focus of my life, I would have wouldn't have believed it. And, you know, things kind of, I think that's what she means, that, you know, this little tree, it, I mean, it's a powerful metaphor because the tree really could grow way taller than the house and, you know, shade the windows and possibly, well, it just can grow much bigger than you think it's going to. And that can be wonderful, or it can be a problem. You know, you don't know. So I think it's, I think it's a powerful metaphor. But I do think we can still enjoy the house. I mean, or those, the things of, the concrete things of our lives, and that there's room for both. Thanks. Anything else? Okay. No other questions, we can end.